appointing me special counsel authorized us to investigate actions that could obstruct the investigation. We conducted that investigation, and we kept the Office of the Acting Attorney General apprised of the progress of our work. And as set forth in the report after that investigation, if we had had confidence that the President clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the President did commit a crime.
Special Counsel Robert Mueller breaking his years-long silence this morning at a news conference in which he did not take any questions. Mueller basically gave the public a Cliff's Notes version of his report. He said there was Russian interference in the 2016 election, but insufficient evidence of a broad conspiracy with the Trump campaign. Still, Mueller also emphasized maybe the biggest point in his report, that he did not clear the President of obstruction of justice. His comments come amid a continued and increasingly aggressive push by House Democrats to have him publicly testify. While not directly addressing that push, Mueller said this.
There has been discussion about an appearance before Congress. Any testimony from this office would not go beyond our report.
Well, here to break down what Mueller said this morning and the path forward is Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Legal Eagle. Hi there. Welcome back. 2 days in a row.
It's like my birthday.
Well, it's definitely mine. Okay. So Mueller declined to clear the President of any wrongdoing, as he did in the report.
Right.
So what is the significance of him actually saying it verbally?
So I had the feeling that there's almost been no one who's more excited to not be in front of TV cameras, that I've never seen anyone so excited to try to avoid congressional testimony before. And I think that, therefore, what Robert Mueller felt was honestly duty-bound to try and set the record straight. I think that what he realizes is most people have not read the report. And I think what he also realizes is that what most people know of the report has been filtered through a variety of sources. And the primary source, of course, is Attorney General Bill Barr, who came out before the report was released with that four-page quote-unquote summary. And this really felt like Robert Mueller's version of, frankly, a rage response and saying, this is what the report actually says, and we were, under no uncertain terms, bound by the indictment. I think the big takeaway is, from day one, before they opened up one legal pad, they knew that at the end of the day, they would not see an indictment for the sitting president, and that was never under consideration.
Right, and so some people have wondered, well, why didn't he recommend some kind of criminal proceeding or some kind of criminal charging after this came out? And this is what he said.
Under long-standing department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office. That is unconstitutional. Even if the charge is kept under seal and hidden from public view, that too is prohibited. The special counsel's office is part of the Department of Justice, and by regulation, it was bound by that department policy. Charging the president with a crime was therefore not an option we could consider.
So, Jessica, he says a word there which was interesting, unconstitutional.
Yeah.
I thought that was just policy. I didn't know this was in the Constitution.
Well, a lot of people, you're exactly right. A lot of people have latched onto that particular phrase, and I've gotten a lot of texts from students and colleagues saying, nothing in the Constitution says you can't indict a sitting president. The founders were clearly aware of this potential issue, and if they wanted to say you can't indict a sitting president, they could have added that sentence. There's nothing in Supreme Court case law that says you can't indict a sitting president, in part because it hasn't been tested. So I think what Robert Mueller is really saying is the Department of Justice policy memo is based on a constitutional interpretation. It's based on the idea that our Constitution sets up separation of powers and that it could potentially violate the separation of powers to criminally charge the sitting president. But there's nothing, I mean, if you were a pure kind of textualist or originalist, you would say what the conservative justices say. Well, I don't see that in the Constitution.
Okay, but he did leave the window open for some other means of continuing with this inquiry, shall we say. Let's play this really short clip.
The opinion says that the Constitution requires a process other than the criminal justice system to formally accuse a sitting president of wrongdoing.
All right. So he's saying, take it out of the Department of Justice and dot, dot, dot.
Here you go, Nancy Pelosi. I mean, you have to think that Nancy Pelosi just was like running around saying, not it, not it, no, because she has really for a long time said that she essentially thinks it's a political loser to go through impeachment proceedings because in order to actually remove a sitting president, you need to impeach in the House by a simple majority. I think Democrats have those votes. But then the Senate, by a supermajority, by two-thirds, has to vote to convict. And I think that she knows right now the votes are not in the Senate. But now what's changed is I think there's enormous political pressure from her caucus to go through with the impeachment proceedings and to go through, frankly, the process of an impeachment investigation, of the hearings, and to think about changing the goalposts for what is a success for impeachment. It doesn't mean that the outcome is predetermined. It means that there's a constitutional duty for Congress to go through that process of looking at the evidence and determining whether or not this accounts to high crimes and misdemeanors. And I think this puts enormous pressure on her.
Well, she did say today that Mueller indicated that there were obvious indictable offenses. That puts her on the record saying the president committed what looks like crimes.
Absolutely. I think her language has become a lot stronger. I think that she realizes she's had both public and private pressure. And frankly, once you say something like there's indictable offenses and you have the special counsel saying, I have no power to do anything, she's the only person left standing. And what Robert Mueller said very clearly is, we don't have the mechanism in the criminal justice system. We can't indict a sitting president. The mechanism constitutionally is to go through impeachment. And then you have Nancy Pelosi saying there's crimes. There's really only one logical conclusion here, but this is a political calculation, so it doesn't mean we reach that logical conclusion.
And the political calculation, is it simply winning 2020?
I think so. Absolutely. I think Nancy Pelosi is looking at the districts and she's seeing who will it harm and who will it hurt when it comes to the strong possibility that the House would impeach and the Senate would not convict. It doesn't mean that she's not thinking about the constitutional duties, the potential that she needs to investigate just in and of itself, but she is an elected, a political partisan official, and it's not unreasonable for her to think about political outcomes.
All right. So there we are again. It's in the political corner, and maybe it never got out of the political corner, but it's firmly there now.
I think it was there, and we just thought, well, maybe Robert Mueller wants to ignore Department of Justice policy. But of course, the former director of the FBI feels absolutely bound by that.
So. And now he returns to private life and hopes never to speak on this again.
But hopes we'll never to speak to anyone and will be wearing a hat and dark glasses for the rest of his life, presumably.
All right. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular legal eagle here on Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you don't provide a standard of care that ensures the safety of women, you shouldn't be allowed to operate. It's that simple. Regardless, or if you support abortion or not, Planned Parenthood should be able to meet the basic standards of health care under the law.
That's Missouri Governor Mike Parson today on why his state is threatening to pull a Planned Parenthood clinic's license to perform abortions this week. If that happens, Missouri will become the only state with no abortion clinics. The state's health department is investigating this clinic because of a, quote, large number of deficiencies. Planned Parenthood says it will sue if its license is revoked. And this comes as many states, Indiana, Louisiana, Alabama, have all moved to severely restrict abortion. Alice Miranda Olstein covers healthcare for Politico. She's been following these developments, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, tell us more about this dispute between Planned Parenthood in Missouri and the governor and the state of Missouri. What is it that the state wants from this clinic?
So the state is investigating what they say have been complaints from patients. And today the governor outlined some of them, not in all of the detail that the public is curious about. But they said that there have been some incidents this year in which a patient had to be transported to a nearby hospital for emergency surgery following a complication with an abortion. There were also other instances where women went to obtain an abortion and had to come back later because it was not successful and they were still pregnant. And so the state is demanding to interview all of the medical providers at the facility, and some have already been interviewed, but Planned Parenthood says that because some are not their direct staffers, they're sort of contracted in, that they cannot compel them to cooperate with the state's investigation. And so Planned Parenthood went to court to prevent this loss of license. They were in court today arguing that they should be allowed to remain open. And because if they are not granted the license renewal, then on Saturday, Missouri will become the first state in the country to have no abortion clinic available whatsoever.
And who will decide whether or not the clinic should stay open?
Well, the court will decide whether this license renewal will either be put on hold or go forward or what will happen there. But the ongoing dispute, the bigger picture, is definitely a different story. There are a lot of states around the country that only have one abortion clinic, and this is the status right now under Roe versus Wade remaining in place. There's a lot of speculation about what could happen at the Supreme Court, but I think it's important for folks to understand that even under current law, where abortion is legal in all 50 states, there are these regulations and laws on the state level that have led to the closure of many, many, many clinics and could lead to Missouri becoming the first state to not have any at all.
Right. And this falls after quite soon after Governor Parsons signed a law that really restricts abortion in Missouri, mm-hmm. isn't it? 8 weeks, after 8 weeks,
yes.
You can't have an abortion.
Yes. So that hasn't gone into effect. And it's confusing because that law was just signed and the clinic closure is potentially imminent, but they are actually not related. This clinic closure and license renewal fight is happening under previous law.
Wow. Okay. And so, as you say, there are all of these other states that are passing not just these other measures in terms of cutting back on access, mm-hmm. Requiring certain procedures like a sonogram or a waiting period or things like that, but mm-hmm. then outright bans when it comes to Alabama and near total bans when it comes to, again, Missouri, Georgia. I think Louisiana is voting this week to ban abortion at 6 weeks. Kentucky, Missouri, Ohio, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. What's happening? Why now? Why are all of these things happening right now?
Well, states have attempted to pass abortion restrictions and some sweeping bans every year. However, you're definitely right that there is a large uptick, and that's because folks who are opposed to abortion ideologically are looking at the new Supreme Court, the new conservative majority with two justices nominated by President Trump who have been confirmed, and believe that this conservative majority on the court will be more open to revisiting Roe versus Wade and even potentially overturning it or sort of chipping away or watering down that standard. We don't know if that's true. We even got some signals this week that it may not be true, which we can discuss. But there is an optimism on the anti-abortion side that has led to just a wave of laws being passed in many, many states.
Right. And what you're referring to is the decision yesterday by the Supreme Court to not take up this the stay on the Indiana law, right, which would have really restricted
right.
abortion. So,
right.
So that indicates that yes. there's a split there in the court, that the court isn't really ready at this very moment to take on Roe v. Wade entirely.
Right. So not to take it on entirely, but I think this week's action was interesting because it was a split decision. They turned away considering a major piece of the abortion ban out of Indiana that would have directly challenged Roe versus Wade and prompted them to reconsider that. But they allowed to go into effect a different piece of the law that requires women who obtain abortions to then have the fetus buried or cremated. And that was sort of allowed on a technicality. They said we might have blocked it as an undue burden on women, which is from a different Supreme Court precedent, that abortion restrictions cannot pose an undue burden on a woman, but that the folks challenging this Indiana fetal burial law did not raise that in their arguments, did not raise the undue burden argument. So we could be back here again. They could be new lawsuits on both pieces of this.
You're referring to Casey versus Planned Parenthood, right?
Yeah.
In that decision. Why didn't the challengers bring up that case in this particular instance?
I don't know. So there are a lot of different ways to challenge this, and the Indiana law had several different pieces, and some of them, like I said, were in direct violation of Roe versus Wade, and some of them were sort of more around the margins. And so these cases take years and years to work their way up through the federal court system. This is actually a law signed by Vice President Mike Pence when he was governor of Indiana back in 2016, and that's how long it's taken for it to get up to the high court. So even though states like Alabama are saying outright that they're passing these sweeping abortion restrictions and bans with an eye on the Supreme Court, with an eye on prompting a reconsideration of Roe versus Wade, that could take many years to actually happen.
But getting back to Missouri, if there isn't a single abortion clinic in that state, doesn't that violate Casey? Doesn't that violate the undue burden prescription?
Well, so currently, under current law, there are many areas of the country where women have to drive hours and hours and hours to get to an abortion clinic. Laws in Texas have led to the closure of many clinics, so there are that situation there in many rural areas of the country. And so, yes, I mean, I think this is an area of law where the justices could really be forced to consider what is an undue burden. That can be kind of a malleable standard.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Alice Miranda Olstein covers healthcare for Politico. Thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely.
Coming up, why some people who care about climate change are refusing to get on an airplane. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The summer travel season officially kicked off over the Memorial Day weekend, and it is likely this travel season to be the busiest ever. TSA says more than 260 million people are expected to pass through airport checkpoints between now and Labor Day. There is a growing group of people, though, largely here in the United States and in Europe, who say they are going to stop flying altogether, or at least severely restrict how often they fly. And it's not because it is unpleasant, which it often is. The reason is climate change. The aviation industry accounts for about 2% of global greenhouse gas emissions, and that number is going up. Here to talk about the no-flying movement is Kim Cobb, professor of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Georgia Tech University in Atlanta. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, so you are among those who have decided to limit your travel or abandon it altogether?
Yes. Yeah, so I'm part of the flying less movement, which means that folks who are interested in reducing their travel mindfully, some of us don't fly at all, but most of us are just trying to cut out some trips on our formerly very full flight schedules to be more in line with our goals around climate change and carbon emissions.
How often were you flying before you did this?
Yeah, so over the last decade or so, as a busy academic scientist, I was flying about 100 to 125,000 miles a year, which put me consistently in the Delta Platinum Frequent Flyer Club. And about 2 years ago, I decided to try to ratchet that down significantly in line with a number of other choices I made in changing my lifestyle around emissions. And I reduced it by about 70-75% from 1 year to the next. So went from that 100 plus thousand miles to about 25,000 miles in 1 year and doing the same this year again.
Wow. How did you do that?
First, I took a really hard look at where those emissions are really coming from. And of course, they're coming from those really long haul transoceanic flights. That's the vast majority of the carbon emissions that were coming from my own flying. And so by looking mindfully at which international trips I could possibly cut out, workshops in Australia, South America, and Europe, I was able to significantly reduce that budget. That was the number one thing that I did. And the other thing that I did is look very closely at what might become some kind of regional hops, like flying up to D.C. frequently. Maybe take the train. Maybe try to remote access wherever I can at different meetings that I can't attend personally. So I had to be pretty mindful. I'm learning a lot of lessons as I go through this. But hopefully other people will think about what they can do to cut out those flights where they can, recognizing not everybody can just stop flying.
So is the idea to pressure the airline industry to offer fewer flights if there are fewer people buying tickets?
Well, the idea is, I think, mostly I don't really have a long-term objective in my own flying less goals. For me, it's a very personal stance. Some folks think that eventually, you know, there's enough appetite for flying less that you can change the number of flights that are scheduled in a given time frame. But the bottom line is we're going to have to collectively find a way to a lower carbon future. In 2050, we can't be flying like this. That's the bottom line.
It's an easier conversation, though, to have when you live in Europe, when you can take trains, when countries are nearby and they're a lot smaller and you have longer vacation times so you can take a leisurely train ride.
Yes.
It's harder to do that here in the United States.
Yeah, that's right. And it's really important to recognize that here in the U.S., distances are pretty long, and we don't have good rail infrastructure, absolutely. But it's also important to remember that not all flights are the same in terms of importance or value to us. And so we might think about those flights that are related to close family travel for weddings and funerals. You're probably going to top the list. And then way on the bottom are those crazy day trips that you feel obligated to take an overnighter, you know, to appear at a workshop for 20 minutes and then fly back across the other coast. Those are the ones that we all love to cut out. And so by assessing which are the flights that you'd like to most readily cut out and trying to find alternative ways to participate in that conversation, that workshop, that conference, we can start to move the needle on how we interact professionally, because we need to build a better infrastructure for remote and virtual access. That's one of the pieces that I'm chewing on as I move deeper into the flying less movement, is trying to get organizations and institutions to provide that kind of infrastructure so people can feel more readily able to skip a flight here and there.
So if the aviation industry accounts for just 2% of global greenhouse gas emissions, how much of a difference does choosing not to fly really make then?
Well, the issue with aviation is that we really don't have a readily available substitute for traversing those kinds of distances with that kind of speed. And so unlike the other things, we can turn to EV vehicles and solar panels and reduce our dependence on other fossil fuel sources. This is one that we're going to have to move away from a behavioral perspective. And so we're just not able to sustain the growth of these emissions through time. So they're growing at some of the fastest segment of emissions that we have. And in the United States, last year from the transportation sector, aviation was tied with trucking for the largest year-on-year increases in United States emissions. And so this is a piece we're going to have to grapple with very quickly, because it's growing so fast, not just here, but all over the globe. And without a readily available technological substitute, we're going to have to be more mindful about when we reach for that plane ticket.
Well, what about buying carbon offsets? You can pay a certain amount when you fly, and that money will go to another program that tries to reduce carbon emissions, like tree planting or something like that. And there's a UN agreement, I understand, where most airlines will have to offer these offsets for in exchange for their emissions. Is that an effective compromise?
Well, I definitely think it's a step in the right direction. And I myself still offset 100% of my flight emissions with a local organization here in Atlanta called Trees Atlanta, where they're putting trees in urban environments, creating shade, getting people out there into our outdoors. And they're great place for me to park my money from flight offsets. The other problem, though, with these kind of click and get an offset on the web is that it's really a poorly regulated market. And so you really don't know where that money is going. And so I would encourage people to look to their own local environments and organizations where they can see the direct benefits of their money going into the ground in whatever kind of greening process they can engage in locally.
So when you consider all the ways that you can amend your behavior to cut back your carbon emissions, to be a better steward of the environment, are there other ways? Like, let's say you just can't cut back on your air travel. You do have to take that trip to the East Coast to visit grandma on Thanksgiving or what have you. What do you suggest would be a near equivalent in terms of amending your behavior?
Well, obviously, it depends on how much you fly, because for me, that was 85% of my personal carbon budget was burned on airplanes.
Oh,
so for
okay.
me, that was very difficult to deny. And for those folks who take multiple trips a year, it is going to dominate your carbon budget. However, I have, you know, exercised a whole menu of different options that keep me engaged. And there are different ways of getting engaged. I started biking to work every day. That reminds me every single day where my values are, even though it's kind of a carbon pittance. This year, I just installed solar panels on my roof, a big deal over there in California. Obviously, helping the grid move towards those renewable energy goals that we know are so important to reducing the utility scale emissions. And then diet is another one that people can reach for pretty easily. Removing red meat from your diet is taking a very big step. It's the single most important step you can take in terms of what goes into your mouth. And then eliminating food waste where you can is also right up there in terms of impactful changes that individuals can make. And so there are a whole menu of options for getting engaged in a process of carbon reductions. And you don't have to do it overnight, and you don't have to be purist about it, and nobody's judging you. It's really about trying to enact your values one step at a time.
Kim Cobb, Professor of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Georgia Tech University. Thank you. Happy non-flying.
I'll see you in California someday, maybe.
Okay. It'll be a long journey, but worth it. Coming up, concert promoter Live Nation is buying up indie music venues like the Echoplex. Will LA's music scene lose its cool factor?
On the flip side, I sort of wonder if that will also then create a vacuum of a sort, that there will be other venues that will sort of arise.
We'll have that next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. When you go to a music concert, you usually have to get your tickets through Ticketmaster, and that charges usually a pretty hefty fee. Ticketmaster is owned by Live Nation. Live Nation also puts on concerts with artists like Madonna and U2, big names at big venues. Now, Live Nation is expanding into the indie music scene. It bought the company that owns and books clubs in Silver Lake, Echo Park, and downtown. That company is called Spaceland Presents. And many indie music fans fear that means the character of these places could change, get more corporate, and ticket prices could go up. Let's talk about this now with KCRW music guru Eric J. Lawrence. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Madeline.
Okay, so what are the clubs that Spaceland operates?
So the core venues that they were dealing with. They've had a number over the years, but the core one that was part of this arrangement was the Echo and the Echoplex, which are kind of related venues mm-hmm. in the same sort of basic block. And then the Regent Theater downtown. And these are sort of smaller venues. These are sort of capacity of well under 1,000 people. And but they are among the most sort of well-respected clubs in town.
Because this guy, Mitchell Frank, books really good bands.
That's right. He originally called it Spaceland Productions because he was working with the club Spaceland, which is over by Silver Lake.
And is that part of this conglomerate?
It is not. No, he had separated from that particular venue a number of years ago. It is now called The Satellite. He took the name Spaceland Productions for sort of his other venues.
Okay, so bands would get their first break at the Echo or the Echoplex and then get scooped up by a major label?
Well, labels is sort of a whole separate other beast. But in terms of bands, when they're building their careers and thinking about ways to sort of increase vertically their successes, They want to play at larger venues. The larger the venue, the more opportunity for
money,
financial reward. Yes, of course. And so I think part of one of the impetus for this decision was that Mitchell was sort of feeling that he was sort of limited by this capacity issue. He reached a ceiling that, you know, he couldn't necessarily offer them a next step.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when they had to go to other venues like the Hollywood Palladium, the Wiltern, you know, moving forward, even getting bigger and bigger, getting places like the Forum. So this was an opportunity for him to be able to connect with an organization that did have access to those particular venues and be able to sort of have a relationship with an artist that goes from this moment where you're just starting out and you're playing sort of these clubs to a couple hundred people, and then eventually you're working your way up to capacities of 1,000, 2,000 and more.
So Live Nation, it's a Southern California company based in Beverly Hills. What kinds of stuff do they do here? They do the big, you know, as I mentioned, Madonna, U2 and all that, but what else are they doing here?
So they cover a number of these different clubs, but they also do a lot of other events such as the Natural History Museum, First Fridays types of events. They have in the past been involved in booking things like the Santa Monica Pier, doing other sort of independent productions.
And just full disclosure, we were involved with that until recently.
Absolutely. We had a relationship with Mitchell from the very beginning that he assisted us in doing some of the productions, such as our masquerade shows. They were involved in sort of helping produce them on sort of a more production level, not mm-hmm. so much in terms of bookings, but more in terms of just creating a venue in a non-traditional venue.
But that relationship doesn't exist anymore.
That's correct. Yeah, okay. We don't have that relationship.
KCRW, we're not affiliated with Live Nation.
Correct.
Just to be clear. Okay. So does he make more money if bands play before larger audiences?
Yes, absolutely. That's, I mean, frankly, in terms of the concert business, that is where the big boy money is.
So we know what he gets out of this.
Right.
What does Live Nation get out of this?
I mean, I think they get sort of something of a parallel, except in the other direction. They're able to sort of see bands from the very beginning. Mitchell has been quoted as saying this is giving him an opportunity to be kind of an A&R man and be able to sort of find these bands that are in their beginning stages, and so that Live Nation can build a relationship with them, and so then be able to then offer them this larger staircase to success when they're coming back around town and playing larger venues as they sort of increase their fan base. So for them, this is an incubator opportunity, mm-hmm. and they've been doing it not only here in Greater Los Angeles, but also in Orange County and San Diego. They've been purchasing some venues in those particular locations, just sort of covering all of Southern California to be able to be really kind of the major player in opposition to AEG.
So what does this mean for the bands themselves, little struggling indie bands who want to make it, or maybe just want to be cool and play, I don't know, the indie scene and not sell out? I don't know.
Yeah, well, this is the question. It's going to be an evolution. Mitchell Frank and Live Nation say that there's not going to be really any changes. He's still involved. He's still going to be working. He has his unit under Live Nation and will be booking shows at these venues. So they're still taking advantage of his relationship with the scenes, with local bands. I think Live Nation's interest may be more on a larger level, wanting to bring in national touring acts and have sort of maybe the smaller level ones and still have venues for them to play here locally that they are kind of in control of. So it may, lock some of the local bands out that are at that level and may change the tenor of those scenes in terms of the way that people view them, in terms of the coolness factor or whatever it is. On the flip side, I sort of wonder if that will also then create a vacuum of a sort, that there will be other venues that will sort of arise to sort of fulfill that aspect of it. And frankly, it may come from different genres than sort of what traditionally the Echo and the Echoplex have been catering to. And we sort of think of them as kind of the indie rock clubs in town. There may be some venues that pop up that will really take advantage of the fact that there's an underground hip hop scene in Los Angeles. There's a lot of electronic music types of bands that will have venues that can kind of serve as an all purpose thing. A lot of bars in town, you know, took advantage of the technology and the music industry shifting sort of around the turn of the millennium, and would then hire, instead of, they used to would have bands play in their venues, but they found it was significantly cheaper to have just a DJ show mm-hmm. up with his laptop and play the music that way. This may now show them that there's an opportunity to have some sort of more live music component to it and bring in a sizable audience that will be, you know, lucrative to them to consider. So there's sort of these opposite poles of what could happen.
Yeah, and we don't know how
it's an evolution.
Out. What about ticket prices? Do you think they'll go up at these places?
I think that is inevitable. But the thing is that's interesting is that I think that was inevitable anyway. As the music industry is shifting and has been shifting over the decades, the issue of bands being able to sustain themselves financially no longer can rely on selling records, selling their music directly to the audience. So live music is becoming an increasingly important part of their financial opportunities. And so I think it was inevitable that, you know, the live experience is going to become sort of a little more of a premium these days. That, of course, does also still put the onus on the bands to actually fulfill that and perform. They call them shows. There has to be some sort of show-like spectacle to it. They can't just
simply... Not just gazing at their shoes.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think at some level that might be, you know, an evolution, a progressive movement that will happen, that bands will begin to realize, okay, we have to do something a little bit different here than just simply go through and play the, you know, a dozen or so songs that we know to people that have probably seen us play those songs already. And so now there has to be some other element to it. A lot of bands have been doing that through the years, of course, but I think that may sort of really introduce that idea to a lot of newer bands that they are performers as much as they are musicians.
There needs to be a little razzle-dazzle.
Exactly.
KCRW DJ and music critic Eric J. Lawrence, always bringing the razzle dazzle. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, fashion designer Rudy Gernreich, inventor of the monokini, the thong, and unisex clothing, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Fashion designer Rudy Gernreich. Not exactly a household name, but in the fashion world, he redefined how the world saw fashion, swimsuits in particular. He took out the inner construction. They went topless with straps in every direction. But beyond that, he was an avant-garde darling of the 1960s and 70s, challenging conventional standards of beauty, gender, and identity. He brought the trends, politics, and art of the time to life using vibrant colors, geometric shapes, and incredible draping in his clothing. Now at the Skirball, you can see Gernreich's innovative body of work in the exhibition Fearless Fashion. And here to talk about the designer and his influence is Danny Killam, co-curator of the exhibition. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Barbara Flood, a model who worked closely with Rudy. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much.
Tell me how you met him.
I had a friend, her name was Ellen Harth. She was a model at the same agency I was, and she was working for Rudy. She came to me one day and she said, you know, I think he'd really like you. I think you should go and have a meeting with him. So I said, of course, because we're all, you know, with an agency, we're all modeling, we're all doing runway things. So I came and met Rudy Gernreich, and the minute I met him, I just fell madly in love with him. And he seemed to like me, so I was on and off with him for the rest of his period. He was an extraordinary designer, an extraordinary human being.
What was it about him? Because obviously, as a model, you'd worked with other designers. What was it about him that was unique? And what about his clothing?
What was interesting about Rudy is that not only was he interested in fashion, but he was interested in politics and the world. He wasn't just involved in making a dress or a no bra bra or, you know, he was interested in everything that happened. He was interested in dance and music and opera and culture and politics. And that was what was so different about him. And I think that came across in his clothes, because when he designed, he sort of designed for the world. He didn't design for himself. He had in mind what he thought people should look like and what they should wear. So he was a very open designer and very eager to learn everything about everything that was going on.
Danny.
Yes.
Barbara mentioned the no bra bra.
Correct, yes.
Explain what that was or is, mm-hmm. and how that fits into his larger vision.
Right. So the no bra bra was an undergarment that Rudy created in 1965. It was a collaboration with the company Exquisite Form. And you mentioned earlier how Rudy removed the interior structures from bathing suits. The first one he did in that vein was in 1952. And essentially what he does with the no bra bra is he applies the same method where he removes the underwire, he removes the padding, and he really wanted the female form to take its natural shape and celebrate the natural form of the female body.
That seems so normal now.
For sure,
but
yes.
Back then, that was revolutionary?
Very much so, yeah. And it was so successful that he then went on to create various iterations of the no bra bra. There was the no back bra, the no side bra, and it was extremely, extremely successful. And like you say, it's a fashion staple of today, something we're very familiar with.
I wish I had one of those today myself.
Well, it was also part of freeing, as you say, the female form, but eventually mm-hmm. he envisioned that men and women could go topless and it wouldn't be a big deal. Like they would be completely equal.
Definitely.
With that.
Yeah.
So he pioneered the monokini.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe what that looks like?
Yeah. So in 1964, Look magazine comes to Rudy Gernreich and they ask him, they essentially ask him, what does the future of fashion look like? And he designs the topless bathing suit, which then becomes known as the monokini. And it's essentially the bottom piece of a bathing suit with two very thin straps that go up and around the above the shoulder, exposing the wearer's chest. So he wanted to remove the shame and negativity around nudity and, again, celebrate our natural form and the body itself. It wasn't about sexualizing the body. It was about freeing the body.
Barbara, did you wear that, model it?
I did. I wore, well, Peggy Moffitt was Rudy's main muse, but we all wore versions of it. And there's a picture of three of us in the New York Times where it says the top comes out of fashion today. And there we are. We're all standing in various shades of black dresses. And it was a very exciting picture, and it upset a lot of people, but it gave a lot of people a chance to become free of their own bodies and to be able to wear what they wanted when they wanted it.
Did he think that actually women would do that en masse? Or,
well,
or was
I don't
it more
know
inspiration
about,
for a different kind of
well,
attitude?
I think it was both. I think it was inspirational. But a lot of women took to it. I mean, I was on the beaches and I was always nude sunbathing and I would travel to Europe a lot and everybody on the beach was nude sunbathing from the beginning before this bathing suit came out. And so I think for certain individuals, yes, it's very freeing. For a lot of people, I think they couldn't do it.
Yeah, and I think he's harking back to his childhood. I think this is something that he sees growing up in Vienna, which was progressive versus the conservative American culture that he moved to in 1938. So in a way, I think he's doing what he knows innately. And I also think Rudy was a master of publicity, and I think he knew how to provoke the audience as well as being a fabulous, fantastic fashion designer.
He grew up in Vienna, Austria. He was Jewish.
Correct.
And he fled the Nazis. He left right after the Anschluss.
Yeah, 1938. Yeah, he was 16 years old. He came over to the United States with his mother, and they actually landed in Pasadena where a family sponsored them. And he pretty much became an Angeleno at that point. He did live in New York City for a few very short stints, but he became rooted in Los Angeles. So it's another reason why we at the Skirball wanted to do this exhibition. It's this kind of hometown story, in a way, really celebrates our community here in Los Angeles.
One of the features in the exhibition is the mannequins are barefoot.
Yes, yeah.
So and that was a big deal for him.
Yes, very much so. So we have 50 mannequins in the gallery, and we made sure that all of them were technically custom in the way that you just described, in that we wanted to create all of the mannequins flat-footed, which is a deviation from the industry standard of today. Mannequins are created for a very high heel. But Rudy sent his models down the runway, as Barbara knows, either barefooted or
in capizio flats, like ballet slippers.
So our mannequins reflect that. And then there are 10 custom mannequins in addition that are based off of exact poses of some of Rudy's models and dancers. And those were actually 3D printed. And they're fantastic. They're amazing. Yeah, they really evoke movement, which was a tenet of Rudy's design philosophy.
But you see, he was a dancer. And most dancers, you know, are not in high heels. And he felt that in order to see the whole form of the outfit, it'd be better to have it go completely down to the bottom of the feet and either barefoot or in these little ballet slippers, because he felt that the high heels weren't right for his kind of clothes. And he was right. And first of all, it was much better for us to walk down the runway barefoot than in high heels anyway.
We talked a lot about the no bra bra and mm-hmm. the bathing suits, but he also designed clothing. Let's talk about that.
Great clothing. You know, at the exhibition, every single piece that I saw we could put on today and wear. I mean, he's timeless in his design world. He's just timeless. He designed then, and every single piece could be worn today without any problem whatsoever.
Describe what they look like, because this is radio. Unfortunately, we can't actually see them whilst we're listening.
Well, basically, they're not skin tight. They're very flowy. And even though they're like a skirt, the movement is away from skin tight.
Yeah, he was also incredibly graphic. He used fantastic graphics in his clothing,
yes.
which I
yeah.
think speak yeah. to today as well. Tim Blanks, who is a fashion historian, just came out with an article on Rudy and stated that he believes Rudy's designs and clothing was the birth of modern fashion, which is a fantastic statement. And I think Rudy was definitely a part of that first step into the styles that we see today.
Why do you think absolutely. He isn't more of a household name, like a Pierre Cardin or a Halston or a Calvin Klein? Why do people not know his name?
I don't think Pierre Cardin is a household name either. But the thing about Rudy was that he died quite young of cancer, unfortunately. Mm. And he didn't have a market all over the world of people selling his clothing, whereas Halston was everywhere and Pierre Cardin was everywhere. And they didn't do a lot of press or PR on Rudy. He just went and did his collections, and the New York Times reviewed him and was always a rave, but he wasn't a household name because he didn't go out to be a household name. He just wanted to do his thing and have certain people wear them, I think. I mean, I don't know. What do you think, Danny?
Well, I think there are two points that I always mention when this question comes up, is that I really do truly believe that Rudy was ahead of his time. And I think people, those
Absolutely.
Types of individuals, they lay the groundwork, but it's the subsequent generations that really kind of pick up the torch and get that recognition. Mm. So I think he mm-hmm. was a figure in that sense for sure. I also think Rudy, you know, had a love-hate relationship with the fashion world. I think he went on sabbatical in 1968 and closed his fashion house. And he,
yes.
what we know today as commonplace with celebrities and designers is he was diversifying in the 60s and creating housewares and fragrance. And he eventually even went into gourmet soup. So
I didn't know that. Gourmet soup?
Yeah, it's this very
wow.
strange anecdote. And Barbara, we actually were serving it at the opening. It was this roasted red pepper soup.
I never got past the exhibition, so I never saw the food.
Yeah. But again, I think the first point I made, like, he was ahead of his time, and those individuals
absolutely.
Tend not to get the credit that they deserve.
I just came across a quote of his. I think he gave it to Life magazine in 1970, and he said, "Tomorrow's woman will divest herself of jewelry and cosmetics and dress exactly
are.
Like tomorrow's man. Fashion will go out of fashion."
And he's so correct.
Very much
so.
In
some ways.
So that quote comes from the Life magazine. That's when he was debuting his unisex collection. So this is actually another commissioned look, same as the monokini. This time it's Life magazine coming to Rudy and actually asking pretty much the same question. What does the future of fashion look like? And he creates a unisex collection where he strips away gender, essentially, and brings us down to, I believe his statement was, our common humanity. And he dressed men and women identically. He shaved the hair off both of his models that debuted
yes,
this collection,
yes.
put them both in skirts that were identical or pants that were identical, jumpsuits that were identical. And in that same article, he actually talks about how in the future, traffic's going to be so bad that we are no longer going to go out to shop. Shopping's going to come to us.
He was ahead of his time.
He very much, yeah. He was prophetic in many, many ways.
Okay, finally, I want you both to, I know it's really difficult. This is maybe the hardest question I'm going to ask you, but I want you to identify your favorite Rudy piece.
I think my favorite Rudy piece was a sample that I had. It's in the exhibition. It's like a little mini dress, and I like mini dresses, and it's red, white, and blue. And it's all in a wonderful check pattern that you could have had 100 years ago and you can have it 100 years from now. Just goes over the head with a pair of tights and a pair of ballet slippers, and you can go anywhere in the world with it. And of course, I'm prejudiced because that was my sample, and there it was in the exhibition. I was quite thrilled to see it.
Yeah. I think for me, it's the selection of the pantsuits that we have on display. So we have four of his pantsuits on display, and they are each named after individuals who kind of pushed against the status quo of their day. So the George Sand suit, the Duke of Windsor suit, the Marlene Dietrich suit. And I just love the messaging that came through in his clothing, both with design and just how he named his collection. It was so dimensional in that sense. And playful. Just a wink. I feel like Rudy was always giving a wink.
Absolutely. He was a consummate artist. I mean, and he was so charming. And it shows in his clothes. The charm comes right across when you see his clothes.
Well, thank you both so much.
Thank you, Madeline.
Oh, pleasure.
Barbara Flood, model who worked extensively with designer Rudy Gernreich, and Danny Killam, yes, co-curator of the exhibition Fearless Fashion, on Vive Now at the Skirball. Well, that's it for Press Play today. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. It's free on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.